So we are officially recording the official first episode of the Minerals Manhattan Project. The Manhattan Project allowed the United States to defeat Nazi Germany.
We're going to be doing one thing, and one thing only, killing Nazis.
Project Apollo put a person on the moon.
It's one small step for man.
And hastened the defeat of the Soviet Union.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Today, I think that Western supply chains are more vulnerable to China than most people realize.
Let's say China.
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 The question that I kind of have is, does the U.S. even want to stay a superpower?
China.
Welcome to the Minerals Manhattan Project. I'm your host, Emily Hirsch, and I'm joined today by Michelle DiGurtolo. Did I get that one right?
You did.
All right. A former White House intelligence briefer and Army combat veteran. Michelle currently serves as a senior managing director at Ancora. Welcome to the podcast, Michelle.
Thanks, Emily. Glad to be here.
Well, I'm really glad also, Michelle, that you agreed to take the bull by the horns and come on a podcast that doesn't exist yet. That was a bit of bravery.
I'm pretty happy to be doing anything with you, Emily. So bravery aside, I think it's going to be fun.
Well, Michelle, can you, one of the conversations that you and I have had in depth that actually kind of led to the genesis, if you will, of this podcast project was the sort of risk assessment in general and how your experience in the military has informed your, I guess, current role talking to the private sector about where risk is and how to manage it.
So I think that, you know, we take a different approach to risk than, you know, most different companies or firms or I guess advisory firms. Part of the reason that I think you and I sort of hit it off is because we have similar sort of approaches to how we identify risk, what we see as risk, and how we help clients to sort of mitigate those risks. And I think my background sort of places me in a position to look at risk from, you know, sort of a more strategic and forward-looking place than some of my colleagues or even our, you know, like people in our industry. I'd love to talk to you about how, you know, how we can get more people involved, how we can, you know, spread the love and the joy when we talk about risk. Because most people, when they think about risk, they're super Eeyore about it, right? They're like, you know, risk is, you know, we're all doomed. But it's not actually, you know, I mean, it's kind of like when people that don't go to the doctor because they're like, oh my gosh, I might find out I have something bad, right? But if you go and you think about it and you identify, you know, hey, maybe I should eat less sugar, maybe I should eat more salad or whatever, you can make changes, right? So it doesn't necessarily mean that you're doomed and you're going to die. It just means that, you know, now you can think about all of these changes and you can make those changes in your daily life, just like businesses can make changes in their, you know, daily business operations.
When I tell you sort of, when you hear the words Manhattan Project, what kind of, what does that evoke for you? Or what are your first thoughts?
Well, of course, for me, when I think of Manhattan Project, I think of like nuclear destruction and disaster, but I also think of incredible innovation in a time of terrible darkness, kind of similar to what we're experiencing right now with this COVID-19. A lot of people are really scared. A lot of people are fearful for the future and for themselves and for their loved ones. I think this, you know, although not apocalyptic per se, I do think that this COVID-19 crisis is going to change us and the way we do business and the way we relate to each other for, you know, decades to come.
And how many times a day, you know, pre-COVID and then post-COVID, or I guess in COVID, does China come up to you or in your line of business? Actually, can you just sort of give me an example of what you do with clients when it comes to looking at risk? I know that you and I have talked a lot about geopolitical risk in that general, but can you, for those of us, you know, I guess out there who don't sit around thinking about risk all the time, like what does geopolitical risk mean? And can you give me an example?
Sure. So geopolitical risk is really looking at, you know, sort of Well, first, geopolitics is kind of the study of, you know, people, places, and power. And it's the decisions that, you know, policymakers have to make on a daily basis to sort of ensure that they have, that scarce resources are distributed appropriately, and that they're, you know, the countries for which they're making decisions are protected and have what they need to survive. So when we look at it that way, it's pretty easy for us to help our clients by sort of modeling scenarios. We help them to, you know, look at the future in terms of, you know, like what could happen, not what will happen. And we do that with a very similar formula that I used when I was in, you know, in the military. We look at, you know, what is the most likely course of action, like what's most likely to happen, what's the least likely to happen, and what's the most dangerous thing that could happen, right? Like, what is the worst thing that could happen to your company? So when we do that, you know, it gives our clients the information they need to make good business decisions, right? It's not that you're never going to have risk, because there's risk inherent in everything we do. I mean, you walk outside every day and you could be hit by a bus, right? Right? Yeah, when we walk outside. So when, in terms of, you know, getting back to your previous question about China, we talk about China all the time because we are, right now, we are still a globalized society, right? Unfortunately, our in the US, our administration doesn't think globalization is a good thing. So we're pulling back, right? And Ian Bremmer, one of my favorite geopolitical, you know, geopoliticians, I guess, wrote a book called G0, and it talks about, you know, how the United States is and has been for some time pulling away from its, you know, global responsibilities and pulling away from being the world power, right? And so he wrote a book on what does that look like and what does that mean for the rest of the world. And I think we're actually, you know, I was just talking to one of my clients about this. I think we're seeing this on an individual level as well, right? You know, we're talking about isolationism, right? And you know, as a global whole, but we're actually isolating ourselves against this virus, right? I mean, we are socially distancing ourselves, and that's on an individual and a community level, very similar to what our government and governments around the world are doing, right? They're starting to take care of themselves and their countries and their needs and self-isolating from other countries. So I just think that was a similar, you know, I thought it was a very similar parallel and important for us to keep in mind as we think about what's going to happen next.
In that kind of analysis, does the world need a superpower? Like what is a superpower? What are those responsibilities, you know, that a superpower, I guess, should do?
So I think the world needed a superpower in the wake of World War II, right? So, and I do think we should have a superpower in the wake of this, you know, COVID-19 crisis. And a lot of people have been, you know, a lot of academics, a lot of experts have been sort of arguing or advocating for that as well, like a big Marshall Plan to help everybody, you know, come back from this, right? What does it mean to be a superpower? Well, the superpower is kind of like the dad of the family, right? The you know, the responsible adult in the room who, you know, helps the children or the family members to make good decisions, to help them manage their finances, to, you know, step in and sort of be, you know, like say, you know, austerity measures are required here, right? You know, son, you can't spend all of your money on, you know, baseball and you know, hamburgers, right? You gotta save for the future, and you gotta do these kinds of things, right? And also to provide, you know, that kind of parenting through crises, right? Like I'm finding that with my son right now, it's very easy for him to get distracted and overwhelmed and not do things that he needs to keep, you know, preparing for the future. I'm like, you really have to do your online classes. I know you don't feel like it, and I know you think you're not learning anything, but you really need to do this so you can, you know, you can graduate on time, you can do these kinds of things, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's what a superpower does. It steps in where it's needed. It provides guidance and stability. And one of the great things about being a superpower is, you know, like, and this came about after, you know, World War II, with the Marshall Plan, we actually made the dollar the reserve currency, right? Like that was a huge and very powerful thing that we did. And we're starting to see that happen again with technology, right? And this is a whole nother, you know, podcast potentially, but the idea of, you know, technology being the currency of the future, or even like information being the currency of the future, that's really important. And that's why, you know, whoever becomes the next superpower, and I do think there will be, I mean, we're multipolar right now. But I do think that a new superpower will emerge. I don't know if that's going to be the US, or I actually don't think it's going to be China. I really don't. I think they would like it to be China, but I don't think it's going to be. But I do think that, you know, whoever emerges, whoever manages to master information and technologies, that will be the next superpower. And I don't think we know exactly who that's going to be.
You go over to China.
China.
China. China.
China.
China. China.
So you and I met in Washington when I was, I think, speaking at a something where I was yelling at people that technology comes from minerals. So I'm going to pivot this to my favorite topic, which is minerals. I see a divorce, if you will, between how people think about technology and how they think about the rocks, where that technology came from. Can you give me a feel for how that divorce came to be? Like, why is it not obvious when you pick up a cell phone that it's made out of minerals that came from rocks?
Well, that's a hard question, but I think a lot of it has to do with, well, there are a lot of aspects, right? Education is one. Right. And this movement that we've had, that we've seen develop over the last, I don't know, 3 decades since the Manhattan Project, this distrust of science. Right. And so, you know, people don't really associate those, you know, those things. Right. I mean, think about, like, my son doesn't understand how the TV works. Right. He's like, it's amazing how those little people in Hollywood come into my living room every day. And he has no idea, like, how that works. Right. And they don't learn that in school, actually. Like, my son, it wasn't even required for him to take physics. He only had to take 3 years of science. So he took, you know, like, earth science, biology, and chemistry, and never took physics. So, you know, he could have chosen to take, you know, physics, chemistry, and biology, or not take earth science or whatever. But I think that part of the problem, that, and part of the reason why people don't understand that, you know, like, these rocks and this dust, you know, is what powers this phone, is because there's not a premium placed on knowledge anymore, and there's not a premium placed on science.
So you were, you know, I've been watching the Trump pressers daily.
We have to fight that invisible enemy that, I guess, unknown, but we're getting to know it a lot better.
I'm sorry for you.
Screaming into the void. You know, it's, listen, I made a bingo game if you want it. It's not fun to play, because you just basically get them all right away. There's definitely been language coming out of the White House about, we inherited a broken system, and also our supply chains, you know, the whole idea of supply chains is coming into focus with the lack of medical supplies. Can you talk about sort of your experience in the federal government, and, you know, this lack of an appreciation for basic science? Can you give us a history lesson on that a little bit?
So I'm not sure that, like, my experience in government is going to help too much to, you know, support the idea of, you know, like, the lack of science, or how science isn't being appreciated. What I can speak to instead is that, you know, there is sort of a dissonance, a cognitive dissonance, in the government, in the military, in the national security, circles, about what is valuable and what is not in terms of information, right? And when you start politicizing science and politicizing intelligence, you start making really bad decisions. And I think that's what we're seeing right now sort of manifest, is that, and this has been happening over time. This isn't just with this current administration, right? And this has been happening over the last 3, maybe even 4 decades, right? Because people are afraid of things they don't understand. And if, you know, science isn't emphasized or taught in schools, then they don't, people don't understand it. And if you don't understand something, then you just try to pretend that it doesn't exist, right? I mean, like, it's like monsters under your bed, right? You tell kids, like, there's no monsters under the bed, just go to sleep, right? So that's what we do. We close the door to the closet, we close our eyes, we turn off the light, and we hug our teddy bears. Instead of trying to, you know, nobody wants to get up out of the bed and open the door and look and see, oh, there's no monster, right? We just pretend, we just ignore it. And I think that that's what's happening today with, you know, this cognitive dissonance, is that some people value the science and try to understand it, and some people don't. And unfortunately, now that's become a political sort of cudgel that politicians use to bang on the heads of, you know, other politicians that do value science.
So I've actually taken from you, with zero crediting of you, by the way, one of my favorite new expressions, which is, if it's not the crocodile closest to the canoe,
that's right,
nobody cares. Explain to me how you evaluate supply chain risk, especially with a supply chain that involves China.
Obviously, that's sort of changing as we speak, right? We're in a sense building the bridge as we walk on it, or as one of my pilot friends used to say, we're building the plane as we fly it, right? In terms of China and supply chains and how we're changing. But over the last 3 years, since, President Trump was elected, we have been highlighting, the way our supply chains are sort of subject to the whims of China, and not just the whims, but subject to the successes and failures of Chinese politics, Chinese economics. And so evaluating the risk, right, that's the part that is the bridge that we're building as we walk on it, right? So over time, we've become dependent on China for many reasons, right? One, because we basically outsourced a lot of our supply chains because, one, the tax structures here in the United States were not friendly, right, to manufacturers.
Can you give me an example of sort of the unfriendly tax structure?
Sure. So for example, pharma is a great example of this, right? So we used to have a really strong pharmaceutical presence in Puerto Rico, right? However, the tax incentives for manufacturing in Puerto Rico were really, really low, right? There were very few, the tax rates were high. I think it was somewhere at one point it was like 24%. And so when Puerto Rico started running into problems with their debt, and they basically went bankrupt, Puerto Rico, when it started to have fractures in its debt, that caused it to cause the manufacturers to reevaluate whether or not it was a good idea to stay in Puerto Rico, right? And that was because there were no tax incentives anymore. The cost of labor was very high. And, Puerto Rico was sort of, there was a lot of uncertainty about what was going to happen in the future. So a lot of those manufacturers looked at places like Ireland, where the tax rate for pharmaceutical corporations is only 6%. Same thing with, let's say, Facebook and Apple. They moved to Ireland because for technology companies, it was 15%. It's still much lower than what the tax burden was in the United States. Not as good as some places, but very reliable. And Ireland had, a lot of other attractive, aspects and factors. So I think that has led to, the supply chains being moved out of, the United States and our protectorates and moved overseas. So there was a huge supply of labor in China and in India and, even in like Bangladesh and other places, Vietnam. So they have lots of labor. They have very low labor costs, very low regulatory environments, very loose regulatory environments. There are tax benefits, right? So it just made a lot of sense when manufacturing companies are looking to cut costs, because that's what they have to do. I mean, margins in manufacturing are actually relatively small. So you have to cut costs somewhere. And by, lowering your tax burden, lowering your regulatory and compliance burdens, and lowering your labor costs, it was a no-brainer, and it just made a lot of sense. Now, China, as it rises to, in its economic stature, and as labor costs rise, along with that in China, it's no longer as attractive as it used to be. there are, increasing regulatory and compliance burdens, not because, China actually really cares about, a lot of their workers, but more because they're facing regulatory burdens from international bodies, right? So like, polluting and climate change and, carbon taxing and all of those things, right? And so that costs them money. So therefore that increased the cost of operating there. And they, the costs that we, the things that, are almost immeasurable, like the IP theft and, some of the other requirements, legal requirements that they have for joint ventures and for, U.S. companies operating over there, it just makes it not as, efficient or cost effective as it used to be. And we're seeing that happen there. We're going to see it next in India. We'll see it in Bangladesh. We'll see it in Vietnam. And what I suspect is that, in light of or in the wake of COVID-19, we're going to see supply chains move back to the United States, and we might even see a lot of manufacturing move back to the United States. But it will look very, very different than what we think of as manufacturing from like the, 60s and 70s and 80s that moved over there, right? A lot more technology driven, a lot more AI driven. I think it'll be a lot different.
Before the coronavirus, I was kind of going on about Chinese debt diplomacy, because here in Latin America and in the mining sector and in the lithium sector most specifically, you've seen the Chinese central bank, I guess, basically make a decision to make capital available with low interest for long periods of time to companies who are in these quote unquote strategic sectors. And one of those being battery minerals. And then now we're actually seeing China sort of showing up to Latin American countries with masks and respirators. So, instead of just debt diplomacy, we're seeing medical diplomacy. How much of an impact do you think China's kind of weight worldwide as an investor is across the board? And then is there anything specific about the mineral sector that makes it different?
So that's a great question. And this lets me talk about like one of my favorite topics, which was, or as you know, is the whole idea of the splinter net, right? And the geopolitics of technology, which is related very closely to critical minerals and to national security. So I think, you and I had talked before about the reason that China is doing a lot of what it's doing, right? And geopolitically speaking, it is absolutely, Beijing is absolutely undoubtedly expanding its footprint, right? And through that, that's through infrastructure projects, which is related to the debt traps, and debt diplomacy. They're doing it through military base building, right? So they built their first military base in Africa. They've tried to put in a naval outpost in, I think it's Sri Lanka. And they, and you have the Belt and Road Initiative that is, it's sort of three parts of the Belt and Road, right? So you have the terrestrial Belt and Road, which was the original Belt and Road. Then you have the maritime Belt and Road, which is also known as the String of Pearls. And then now we have this like Arctic Belt and Road, right? So so China is absolutely trying to expand its influence, but it is not because it wants to take over the world. It is rather, again, geopolitics, right? This is a country that is trying to protect its own interests and make sure that its, population has enough food and make sure that its population is well defended and make sure that its population can grow economically so that, it can not only lift people out of poverty, but, it can push the majority of the population into the middle class, which is really important. And especially in a country where the government is, it's a communist government, it's still a communist government. And a communist government trades three things for I guess support and loyalty, right? So they trade competence in economics, in security, and in just, governance, right? So if the, if the Chinese government can make and execute good economic policies that lift everybody, right? The rising tide lifts all boats, and it can keep its population secure, right? And it can, you know, keep the, and it can deliver on all the other aspects of governance, which provide those essential goods and services to, you know, a majority of the population, then people are willing to give up, you know, certain freedoms and human rights and, you know, and they're, and basically it's an exchange, right? Well, this isn't, you know, this is a balancing act. This is not an easy thing to do, especially when you have 1.4 billion people, right? This is very hard. So in order to do that, you have to expand your presence and you have to make relationships, right? It's a very homogenous population. Not very many foreigners live in China, right? At least, you know, not permanently, right? They'll go there to do business for a while and then they leave. They don't go there to, like, you know, live in China and become Chinese citizens. So China is facing, you know, in terms of those, you know, delivering on, you know, good governance and economics and, you know, essential goods and services, it is facing a huge problem right now. And it's not something that's easily solved. And that problem is a demographic problem, right? So we know that, you know, for the last three decades, as a result of, you know, a confluence of events to include, you know, the one child policy, to include the rapid industrial rapid industrialization, right, which you know resulted in significant amounts of pollution, a number of cancer villages, and just all sorts of other, you know, like malign byproducts. You know, the population is declining, and then also just because it is in decline, I mean, that's what happens to populations. So. They don't have a large chunk of the population that's needed to keep the, you know, that promise, that economic promise of, you know, economic growth, that rising tide that lifts all boats, and the deliverance on the, you know, essential goods and services that requires the population to work and be productive, right? And so labor, now is, there's a huge chunk of the labor force that's missing, right? They're either, you know, not there because they were never born because of the one child policy, or they're out because they have cancer from, you know, or other illnesses as a direct result of pollution, or they're caring for those people that have, you know, cancer or other illnesses, right? So in order to make up for that, the Chinese are turning toward to technology, right? As we all do. And so in terms of technologies, AI is supposed to be, you know, holds the promise of being able to turn the output of one worker into the output of 5 or 10 workers, right? And AI is, you know, one of those things that requires like gobs and gobs and gobs and gobs of data, right? And you would think, you know, hey, China's got 1.4 billion people. That's like a lot of data points for, you know, for them to use to make really good AI. The problem is that AI really is kind of like genetics, and it needs to be heterogeneous, right? It needs to have, if it's all just homogeneous, then it gets corrupted over time, right? So what the Chinese are doing in this whole expansion, and I promise I am getting to the point, circling back to the beginning, in this whole expansion, right, this, you know, Belt and Road, et cetera, is that they are trying to provide or trying to get more data from exogenous places, right? And this is where we get to that technology piece of the splinternet, right? Whereby, you know, China develops its own version of 5G and the West develops its own version of 5G. And you say, well, what does this have to do with national security or even critical minerals? Well, it has everything to do with that, because the places in which China is trying to establish these 5G networks, right, similar to the debt trap that you just mentioned, by offering, you know, like very low cost loans and, you know, or interest-free infrastructure, right, are places where those critical minerals live, right? So all over Africa and all over Latin America. So there is a method to the madness. If they offer, so instead now of offering, you know, like infrastructure for, you know, like low cost loans or debt free, you know, or low interest loans or, you know, or even free, now they're offering free infrastructure, free 5G infrastructure, and saying, hey, you know, I know that your company, your country is struggling and you're having some, you know, some budget problems, a cash crunch here and, you know, this, that, and the other. we're going to help you out. We're going to help you to deliver, you know, commerce and e-commerce to your people through this, you know, 5G really fast internet. And we're going to help you get it out all across your country. And we're going to do that for free. But it's not really free, because what they're asking for is the data that travels along those networks, right? And so what they do is they, similar to these debt traps, they, you know, instead of them owing them money, they owe them data, right? And then when they get there,
and if information is the currency of the future.
Yes, bingo, you've got it. Exactly. So that's how they're, you know, that's how it's all tied together, right? And these critical minerals are a national security issue for the West, especially the United States, because many of the, you know, almost all of the products that we're going to use in the next in the foreseeable future are going to connect to the Internet of Things in some way, right? I mean, everything, even my garden right now, like I just put in a garden, and I have this little device that tells me, it connects to the internet, and it tells me when my soil needs to be watered, and it tells me the acidity levels, and it tells me, oh, you need to buy more plant food, and you need to do this and that, and what everything. I mean, literally everything is going to be connected to the Internet of Things, right? And in the national security space, there are so many different things that require currently and in the future that will require critical minerals, everything from satellites to missiles to like smart weapons and precision weapons, and even, you know, like even the plasma screens that I use, you know, to do my daily updates, right? Like when I'm looking at the screen and I'm telling the, you know, the president or whoever I'm, you know, briefing, all of that requires critical minerals, all of it. And so if China is the only place producing them, that's a huge vulnerability for the United States, because if they all of a sudden decide, like they did with Japan, that like, hey, we're not sharing, we're not trading, we're going to keep ours, you keep yours, good luck with that. That would be horrendous, right? I mean, like that would be really, really bad. So, so that's why that's how it's all sort of connected together.
It is all connected together. And so it's sometimes quite complicated to try to express the importance of minerals in all of this, because you need the context to understand why they're important. My last question for you, and I'm going to just kind of take advantage of your sort of risk evaluation and how I've heard you talk about supply chains in the past. What is the next surprise that we're going to see from this whole coronavirus saga? Like, what's the next thing that's going to come out of nowhere?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball, so I don't know.
Exactly. I guess what crocodiles are circling the canoe?
Well, there are actually quite a few. And this is because of the interconnectedness, right? So you can't just say that, well, now that China is recovered, which by the way, it's really not, you know, now that China's recovered, everything's going to go back to normal. And then, you know, the US or Europe will recover next, and then the US, and then whoever gets it next, which is likely to be like India or whatever. It doesn't work that way, because global supply chains are so integrated now that there are a lot of dominoes. Some of the things that I think are going to be problems for supply chains include labor and employment issues, right? I think that's going to be a problem. Shortage of labor, especially. So when you look at, you know, let's just take India, for example, right? Because it hasn't happened there yet. You know, they could have upwards of a million people that don't survive COVID, right? There are a lot of other industries that really, really rely on the Indian workforce, right? Third country labor. So like the oil and gas industry, for example, right? There are a lot of Indians that work in the Middle East on oil and gas, you know, supply chains, right? Everything from, you know, upstream, midstream, downstream, you know, refining, all of that stuff, right? So if you take a million of those people out of the, you know, the supply chain, it's going to have impacts broader than what happens, you know, broader than just India. So I think that's one place that we're not looking at. I think another thing that we're probably not thinking about that we should be in terms of supply chains are how are these businesses that are, so there's right now, corporate debt is ridiculous. I mean, it's exploding. It's the worst that it's ever, ever been, right? So many companies are not going to survive this just because of the debt burden, right? They don't have 30 days of cash flow to, you know, to be able to sustain themselves. And the government bailout is not going to be enough to save everybody, right? I mean, the government just doesn't have enough money. And so they're going to have to basically make those terrible choices about who lives and who dies in terms of companies, right? Who gets a corporate bailout and who doesn't. So I think that's something else that we should be looking at, especially in the energy industry. I think that there are a lot of energy companies that are either not going to make it or they're not going to make it out whole. There will be a lot of consolidations, there'll be a lot of restructurings, and there will be a lot of bankruptcies. There'll be a lot that don't make it. So I think in terms of supply chains, you know, that's going to be a big issue. Who makes it and who doesn't, right? Because if an oil company doesn't make it, that means that all those supply chains, all those suppliers, those won't make it either, right? Because they depend on the oil and gas industry to buy their products. So I think that we'll see a lot of conversions, right? We're already seeing conversions, instant conversions, like places like GM. GM is now, instead of manufacturing cars, right? They're not manufacturing any cars. They're manufacturing masks and, you know, and ventilators, right? So I think what we'll see is supply chains shifting to accommodate need, because that's how capitalism works, right? Resources go to their most useful applications. And so that's what I think we'll see in terms of what's next in the supply chain.
So we're all quarantined. Is there anything that you panic bought that in retrospect you were like, why did I buy all of these? Or any other fun anecdotes you have from being locked inside?
So two things, actually. So I needed deodorant, but when I went to order my brand, it only comes, they won't sell me just one. So I bought 24 cans of deodorant. I was like, well, nice. I'd rather have 24 than none. so that was one. And then the other thing, I bought like four like things of flour. I'm like, what am I going to do with all this flour? I can't bake that much bread. I mean, seriously, I do love to bake. And like you, I'm basically fear baking. It is lowering my anxiety, but increasing my waistline, unfortunately. So we have been making like breads, and what did we make yesterday? Oh, we made a chocolate cherry cake, which none of us even like chocolate cherry cake. I don't know, but it looked good on the cover of a magazine, so we made it. But yeah, that's kind of what happened.
Well, look, Michelle, thank you so much again for being on the Minerals Manhattan Project. Again, I'm your host, Emily Hirsch, and my guest, Michelle DiGrutolo.
That's right.
DiGrutolo has been my first guest, and hopefully this won't be her last time on the podcast. If you want more of the Minerals Manhattan Project, we are online at www.mineralsmanhattanproject. You can find us at all of your podcasting apps, iTunes, etc. I'm on Twitter at Lithium Podcast. Michelle, do you do any social medias?
Not really. I'm on social media, but only in a personal capacity, not
listen,
work.
You're missing very little. If you want me to call you every now and then, just like scream obscenities at you, like you can, I will deliver it to you in one quick dose. And yeah, that is all. Thank you so much for being on.
The Minerals Manhattan Project is hosted by Emily Hirsch and produced by Emily Hirsch and Elena Peach. To continue today's conversation, follow Emily on Twitter at Lithium Podcast and visit our website at batterymaterials.energy. Enjoyed today's episode? Please share with others and rate the Minerals Manhattan Project on wherever you get your podcasts. Have content suggestions or interested in being featured as a guest in a future episode? Please contact us via our website or the Twitters.